of paper 119, right at the beginning. And we don't need any intro here. The title says it all. The preface will definitely serve as the intro and getting us moving into the space that the author would like us to. That if you look carefully, you'll see that you don't want to think of this as a preface to part four. This is a culmination of part three. And he tries to move you in that direction, but only if you choose to notice. So we'll make sure that we pick up on his little clues there as we go through the preface here. So let's start up.
Paper 119, The Bestowals of Christ Michael. Chief of the Evening Stars of Nebadon, I am assigned to Urantia by Gabriel on the mission of revealing the story of the seven bestowals of the universe sovereign, Michael of Nebadon, and my name is Gavalia. In making this presentation, I will adhere strictly to the limitations imposed by my commission.
Okay. Now, there's a big gap there. So let's just stop. Oh, and I guess probably everyone found it. I guess I forgot to mention it's old single column, page 1308, if you are having a tricky time finding that yet. Okay, so first off, you want to notice this is, a little bit different than the norm. Rather than as a little, comment at the end of the paper, right at the beginning, the author's saying who he is. If you think about it a second, you'll realize one of the reasons why. Because when you go to the end of this paper, remember we mentioned when we started these five papers that you had that very curious little header note for a preface in the first of the five papers, and you have this extended, not just byline, but footer note at the end of the five papers. So in many ways, the way they've constructed it, like we pointed out, in this centered fashion where it's in complete parallel moving from the beginning and the end to that central section that has the mother in it. It's obviously tied to that instead of having this little bit at the end, it's here at the beginning. So just little things like that, see, are there if you notice them. Now, he's chief of the Evening Stars. It's Gavalia. Galantia and Gavalia are the first of the two different types of brilliant evening stars. You have the ones like Gavalia is the first of, the ones that are created as a brilliant evening star. And then you have the other group who ascend up to that nature. And the first to do that was Galantia. So it's a pretty significant individual, and you notice I am assigned to Urantia by Gabriel. If you don't remember, the brilliant evening stars are Gabriel's deputies. They very definitively function in his stead. He has to be at lots of meetings, but he can only be at one place at a time, so he needs deputies to be at all these meetings. Just, it's something that simple, not to mention everything else that you could think of. Brilliant evening stars are significant in a number of ways relative to human history. If you're reading through the Old Testament, you'll notice there's occasionally reference to someone that they say, that they label as the angel of the Lord. Not an angel of the Lord, but very specifically, many places in the Old Testament, it's the angel of the Lord. And now, not every single time, you know, we can't think simplistically about the Old Testament like that. But they point out, when they introduce the brilliant evening stars, that many times there was an actual, real visit, not just an imagined one or whatever, or a mythological one, but an actual visit by a being named that, and that was a brilliant evening star, you know, not an angel, you know, in the simple sense, but sort of a super angel, a brilliant evening star. Young Jesus hears it's time to be about your Father's business, that's a brilliant evening star saying that, because they accompany on the bestowal missions. So it's, you know, it's time to be about your Father's business, or it's time to be about your brother's business, depending on if it's a Michael or an Avonal son. So they're, they have a lot of significant, you know, connections to the greater story here. Of bestowals. Let's see, what else do we have there? Let me answer this question first. Yeah.
Thank you. Do we have an etymology in Gavalia?
Nope, I don't. I haven't figured out Gavalia or Galantia. Because I just haven't had time to dig. Now think about that last sentence. Okay. Your first thought should be, yeah. Was he thinking I was going to assume that one of the revelators was going to cheat on the revelatory mandate? In making this presentation, I will adhere strictly to the limitations imposed by my commission. Why on earth does he state apparently the obvious? Okay. You know, he didn't burn that many words in the invaluable real estate for no greater purpose. He wasn't just telling you something that it was self-evident, that you already knew, that you've been told 500 times or whatever. Okay, so think about it. I will adhere strictly, okay, to the limitations. In other words, pay very, very close attention. What he says is wrapped as tightly around what he can't say as he can wrap it, so that there's no gaps. So if you look at the outline of what he says, there's a clue about what he can't say. It's like, you know, doing a facial mask, okay? He's creating an outline of the negative space, the stuff that's outside the revelatory mandate. If you pay really close attention, he's telling you, that's why the word strictly is there. He's literally wrapped it around and he's pulled it as tight so that rope is cinched right around it and then follows every little nook and cranny that, you know, are around it. Okay. That's why he's saying that. So it's very worthwhile. There's no way you're going to find everything, but you want to be, he's telling you right up front, the first thing he really tells you after he introduces himself is to look for the shape of the outline of what I say, not just what I say. That's significant too, but look at the shape of the outline of what I say. All right.
The attributes of bestowal is inherent in the paradise sons of the universal Father. In their desire to come close to the life experiences of their subordinate living creatures, the various orders of the paradise sons are reflecting the divine nature of their paradise parents. The eternal Son of the Paradise Trinity led the way in this practice, having seven times bestowed himself upon the seven circuits of Havona during the times of the ascension of Grand Fonda and the first of the pilgrims from time and space. And the eternal Son continues to bestow himself upon the local universes of space in the persons of his representatives, the Michael and Avonal sons.
Okay. Now, the you know, just when they speak about this inherent nature of downreach here that bestowal is related to, always be reflecting on the labels that we have for the different facets of deity and think about whether or not there might be some connection that they're alluding to. The sevenfold is creature-identified deity. See, so obviously that is going to have some relationship to this, you know, and we certainly know that if you follow the sevenfold creators down, or you know, you're going to get to the Creator Son. You're starting with the Eternal Son. Very much that the sevenfold creators are reflecting this downreach that, you know, he's referring to here, that bestowal is such a fundamental part of, the act of identifying with the creatures that are created. And I want to go back. You don't have to turn back. I'm just going to read a couple sentences from up in the Eternal Son paper, related to what they're alluding to here. So just kind of remind yourself a little bit of what's being touched on here, talking about the bestowals of the Eternal Son in Havona during the times of Grand Fanda. Here, you know, you do have an etymology. Fand is an archaic verb now. Means to seek. So literally, you know, you can sort of speak the truth of what Grand Fanda is. Grand Fanda is, in other words, he's the ancestor of all who seek the Father. You know, grand ancestor, okay? And they use that A, just that generic nominative Latin suffix A, when they want to indicate that there's some sort of assumed things, you know, so it's okay to sort of, you know, lay out a sort of a whole sentence, you know, rather than just the immediate literal parts of the word. He's the ancestor of all who seek the Father. That's why they chose coined that English name for him. Okay, so if you want to, you know, on your own, go back and read about the spirit of bestowal, it's section 5 in the second of the Eternal Son papers. But I just wanted to give you a couple little things here. One of the things that the Divine Counselor says back there is, the bestowals of the Eternal Son in Havona are not within the scope of human imagination. They were transcendental, which this should be self-evident. We're talking about the Eternal Son, after all. And then a little later on, he says, whatever our difficulty in comprehending the bestowals of the second person of deity, we do comprehend the Havona bestowal of a son of the Eternal Son, who literally passed through the circuits of the central universe and actually shared those experiences which constitute an ascender's preparation for deity attainment. This was the original Michael, the firstborn Creator Son. And he passed through the life experiences of the ascending pilgrims from circuit to circuit, personally journeying a stage of each circle with them in the days of Grand Fanda, the first of all mortals to attain Havona. So, they didn't bring up all that, but I just wanted to remind you that despite the fact that you might have initially been thinking about, wow, the Eternal Son, that must have been, how does an infinite person, you know, bestow himself, and how would you have any relationship to such a fact? You don't really. Not even Havona natives did, or still do. That the way that they have access to that bestowal of the Eternal Son is via that first Creator Son. See, who's in a different mode than all the Creator Sons that are out in local universes. He was created relative to Havona. And remember, we kind of mentioned, if you stop and reflect a minute, it's like, that means there's a creative spirit that's tied to Havona. You know, we brought that up when we were thinking about the mothers, you know, the various mothers and the womb of mind and stuff involved in different parts of the universe. So, literally, you've got that Creator Son, that first Michael, moving along with that first group of ascending mortals, you know, of whom Grand Fonda was the point man. But there was a whole group, you know, moving through Havona with him.
Yeah. So, Chris, what you just reflected on or summarized was what the chief evening star was allowed to reveal.
Well, I mean, he's just, remember, we're at the last paper of part three. I mean, so everything in the first three parts of the book are fair game to be alluded to. You know, they expect you to remember everything, okay? Now, obviously, you don't necessarily, but you should be thinking that way. It's like, you know, I better try to touch back and see what he might be alluding to. Maybe it has some bearing upon, you know, what assumptions are in play that I'm trying to build upon here. You know, this paper builds upon all that went before it in the book. You know, this isn't an island universe. Okay? If you want less distortion of meaning rather than more, you know, it never hurts to try to keep in mind, you know, and even go back and read a little bit. Like, well, what did they say about brilliant evening stars? What did they say, you know, et cetera.
My logical mind's kicking in here. When you said the sun, the first sun, eternal sun, is bestowing himself at the city, moving right along with Grand Fonda, that was an anomaly in my mind, because Grand Fonda is moving inward toward paradise. The eternal sun's probably coming the opposite direction, even though...
But the
tangent.
First Michael is going along with
Grant.
The
first Michael, okay.
The first Michael who you can think of as, you know, I shouldn't say it that way. How should I say? An embodiment expression of the Eternal Son. So the two are synchronized in this effort. You know, the Eternal Son is bestowing himself in a highly transcendental way. But there's a shadow cast, if you will, that is literal, tangible. It is that first Michael. As the Eternal Son moves through Havona, he moves through Havona. And you're right. You know, notice how one of the very first things that's happening is a bidirectional flow. How many times have we pointed that out? See how, you know, you follow something all the way back to a very origination point, like the original Michael, and you see that bidirectional pattern. It's very, very fundamental.
What's significant, it doesn't just say the Eternal Son, it says the Eternal Son of the Paradise Trinity.
Oh, yes, thank you for reminding me of that. I didn't want to skip that, and thank you for reminding me. Yeah, just notice that little subtle thing. Very, very good. You should catch that, go, oh, look at there. They're wanting me to be thinking top down, aren't they? They want me to really kind of be in that mode where in my original conception, I have the Paradise Trinity. And then out of the Paradise Trinity, I distill the three parts that are individuatable and personalizable, the three absolute persons. See? So you have the Eternal Son of the Paradise Trinity. That's a top-down phrasing, and not the bottom-up phrasing, where you think of the Paradise Trinity as the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the pre-existent three. And that's more the seven absolutes of infinity, you know, starting point, viewpoint. That, you know, that's their grand exalted attempt to take the individuality viewpoint and take it sort of to its highest possible level of validity. In the beginning were the seven absolutes of infinity, and then you try to understand everything with that starting point. But, you know, just notice that wording. You know we're talking about a descending sun moving down through these bestowals. You know, right there, that phrasing is a downward phrasing.
So the Universal Father does not do that. He doesn't go down like
nope.
The Eternal Son does.
Nope.
He just stays here. But then the Eternal Son, he actually is going, bestowing himself upon the seven serpents of Havona. And then from him comes the Michael and the Havona sons. Correct? So what are the seven serpents of Havona?
seven circles. You know, Havona is in seven circuits. You know, ring of planets, an inner ring of planets, an inner ring of planets, and you know, it's in seven concentric circuits, the billion worlds.
And that was the billion perfect worlds, and that's where the eternal sun did his.
Yeah, and worlds. The original Michael. The original Michael, it's not about local universes, it's about Havona. Yeah. Because you know, when you say creature identified deity, the sevenfold, that's not just, you know, creatures out here in the seven super universes. There's creatures in Havona that the sevenfold is reaching down to as well. Okay, those are creatures. They're Trinity origin creatures. They're a different kind of creature than we are, but they're creatures. And that whole point you're just making about how the Father doesn't have this downward bestowal, and very literally like this, but remember who the Father is. God the Father is the initiator. That bestowal phenomenon was initiated by the Father. He doesn't do it, but he initiates it. Just like he doesn't do the mother thing, but he initiates the mother thing. You know, remember how they very carefully said he would, you know, first think of him as a creator, then as a controller, and lastly as an infinite upholder. You know, they didn't, they went ahead, you know, and just dropped the universal, you know, and made a lowercase c creator controller. You know, they're just speaking of it generically, but they very purposely didn't just say upholder, you know, lowercase u. They put the word infinite in there because you have to recognize that that upholder aspect of reality is, yeah, is predominantly, you know, the root of the mother phenomenon. But it has to be initiated in some way. It's initiated on the infinite level by the Father, and then, you know, the actual literal mother, you know, extends all the way down. Absolute, absolute, you know, the supreme, you know, the finite, all the way down through the finite, down through the cosmic mothers, all the way down in parallel to the sevenfold, right down to creative mother spirits. You know, and even, you know, in many ways, down to every, you know, female.
As Pam was asking that question, I was thinking, well, God the Father has bestowed himself individually upon all of us.
Right, he bestows thought adjusters, but you know, he doesn't actually have this incarnating bestowal phenomenon. Yeah, so, yeah. It's not as how do you want to say that? I mean, you know, literally, like I said, if you use a word like embodiment, you know, you're literally taking a creator son, and the totality of the creator son is becoming embodied within Jesus of Nazareth. It's not like he's breaking off a chunk of himself and throwing it on the planet. It's a different, you know, it's a literal embodiment into whatever form, be it corporeal or otherwise. You know, the whole nature is being bottled up inside. All of Michael was inside of Jesus. That's what makes it so profoundly mysterious. How, you know, no one can figure this out. High and low. How do you fit that in there? I thought of, a cup couldn't hold a quart, you know, and now you're telling me it's holding a 50-gallon drum. I mean, how does this work? So, all right. So, yeah, thank you very much, Jean, for bringing that up. So, the Michaels and the Vonals, you have the sons, the Michael sons that are very coordinate with the eternal Son, in this sense, but then also the subordinate sons, the Vonal sons or the magisterial sons, also do the bestowals, you know, and then except for the one planet in the local universe, you know, they do the bestowal missions on all the other planets. All right.
When the eternal Son bestows a creator Son upon a projected local universe, that creator son assumes full responsibility for the completion, control, and composure of that new universe, including the solemn oath to the eternal Trinity. not to assume full sovereignty of the new creation until his seven creature bestowals shall have been successfully completed and certified by the Ancients of Days of the super universe of jurisdiction. This obligation is assumed by every Michael son who volunteers to go out from paradise to engage in universe organization and creation.
Okay. Some, I want to point out the keywords that we have in play now, because we, you know, went so carefully through the previous four papers here. First one that should catch your eye is projected. Remember, we pointed out that that's a very fundamental keyword. It's pointing to, you know, you have the self-projected deity, the infinite capacity, and the architects of the master universe being fundamental in their relationship to that infinite capacity, and this projection of capacity downward. So they're reminding you of that, just in using that word in passing. So, you know, you could go back and refresh your memory about that, how that works. And then the other thing, of course, is including the solemn oath to the eternal Trinity. Not the Father, not the Son, not the Spirit, to the Trinity. You know, so you want to go, why? You know, and then just to boot, an Ancient of Days, you know, being very, or the Ancients of Days being very intimately involved in this. Ancients of Days are supreme Trinity personalities. The Trinity, it's Trinity heavily in this paragraph. You get into, before you move on, you got to say, okay, what's he pointing me to there? He's saying that this child of existential parents, a creator son, child of the existential universal father, and the existential eternal son, is going to go out, and he's taking a solemn oath to the Trinity, the origin of experiential deity. Right? Remember, really remember that. The first center is the origin of existential. The other side of the coin, the other side of the universal one of infinity, is the origin of experiential deity. Okay? He's taking an oath to the Trinity that what he's going to do will always take full recognition of the of evolution. You know, would you do this now, Jesus? No, my hour has not yet come. You know, he's doing everything very, very carefully, so that it's synchronized with the hand of the mother. Because if he doesn't, you know, why is it a solemn oath? If he were to break that, he would be in rebellion.
Yes. So the Eternal Son, he creates the Havona. I mean, he's the father of Havona. Like
no,
the
no.
The Creator Son would be the father of all the, of our universe.
No, no. Why no, not? No, the way Havona comes into existence is a direct expression. As soon as the conjoint actor, you know, the third person, comes into existence, Havona comes into existence. So, you know, the Eternal Son is you know, you shouldn't think of him as a creator to Havona like a creator son is a creator to a local universe. It's different. In the same way that first Michael is not a creator son really relative to Havona, like a, you know, he's a very special Michael, that original one. He's not serving as completely in that creator, if you will, or guider over controller mode like a creator son is, you know, out in the local universes. I mean, Havona, you know, is a pattern universe for the seven super universes, but you never want to forget about, it's not just, you know, a fancy eighth one. You know, it has a lot of things about it that are different. But it has a lot of things that are definitely in parallel, because that's the source of the patterns out here. Why are there 7 billion local systems in the super universe level? Because it's a sevenfold expression of a billion, the billion of Ona worlds. You know, our local system ties back to one of the billion worlds of Avona. Our local system is being patterned evolutionarily on one of those billion worlds. As that billion that particular world of those billion is expressed in a sevenfold fashion, you know, we're one of the facets of its sevenfold expression. Or at least we will be when all is said and done, when all is settled in light and life. And it's just on and on and on like that. I mean, all these parallels, because it's the pattern universe. It can't help but be parallel.
Are you suggesting that we might go to those worlds to see
how? I'm suggesting that should pique your curiosity about that world when you get there. Well, I got to make sure I spend some time there. That might feel a lot like home. Now, there's a world waiting for you. See, that is basically yours. You know, it was made so that you could be. You're part of its image, and then all the beings that are on there too. You know, those beings are synchronized with that world. So, think about how those beings that you'll meet there, how they're going to be different than all the other beings.
So, Chris, it would seem to think that it would be our heaven on earth. Because we won't come back here.
Yeah, that whole bit about the new heaven, you know, and coining the word Havona literally to just, you know, represent that term from Revelation, the new heaven. And that's a very personal thing, you know. Literally, one of those worlds is very intimately our part of that new heaven.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's solemn oath that, he will always make sure that his existential nature doesn't get ahead of the experiential reality that he's inserting himself into. I mean, he's there to upstep it, but only in perfect synchrony with it. It's not going to drag anything forward. Okay, that's rebellion.
These guys don't get anywhere early.
Yeah. It sounds like an
engagement. Right. Yeah. See, and just... You see, no wonder when all is said and done with his bestowals, then, you know, you really can have this completed betrothal with the Creative Mother Spirit. He's really synchronized then. He's not only synchronized with her, he's synchronized with all of the rest of the supreme creators and controllers. Like we pointed out, you start out and Master Spirits, the Ancients of Days, and then all three levels of the controllers, they're all very much... on the supreme page to start with. But the creator sons are merely creator sons to start with. They're not master sons. There's some time delay in them getting fully up to that supreme state where they fill out that whole lower block of the sevenfold, so that there's the supremacy is complete in the lower block of the sevenfold, which means that the Spirit of Truth can you know, bring the supreme level down to you. If in levels 1, 2, and 3, if supremacy has a gap in it, there's no way to get the supreme level, the third circular level, down to you as a seventh circular. It can't make it through. There's a chasm it can't cross. But as soon as he fills in that gap as a master son, Now the Spirit of Truth can span that gap, and you can get a thought adjuster when you're just a seven circler. So right there, just thinking about that, you know what you really want to be looking for. You know, one of the very first things is pointing to what he's up to here in these bestowals, you know, and filling out the supremacy in the lower three levels of the sevenfold. He's about acquiring a measure of the nature of the supreme in these bestowals so that he fills it out.
Well, this relationship to the creative spirit and then the creative mother spirit. Like, he starts out with free will. But she seems to start out...
highly non-personal.
Right. But by his fidelity over time and through this process, she achieves...
Right, you see how to understand...
He frees her from her.
You can't understand the one without the other. I mean, everything about them is synchronized. I mean, we'll actually touch upon that a little bit here at the end of this section, this preface. Always think about, if you begin to understand something about a creator's son, always think about the reflection over onto the mother side of the equation, and how that's coordinated. Most of the time you can't, you can very easily see how you can't do one without the other. One side of the equation without the other. We know that it's most fundamentally expressed in just the two words that we use for the differential between male and female: place and direction. Female and male, place and direction. Obviously, there's he can't direct anything if there's no place in which to direct. She has to establish place first. That being so fundamental, and why create a place if you're not going to do anything with it? See, it works both ways. That affects everything. Everything about them is synchronized like that. So when one is achieving something, the other is achieving something. In the same way that that descending hand of the universal mother is synchronized with the ascending nature of the Almighty Supreme. You've got this fundamental coordinated thing. Dunk, 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 dunk. It works in sync.
The purpose of these creature incarnations is to enable such creators to become wise, sympathetic, just, and understanding sovereigns. These divine sons are innately just, but they become understandingly merciful as a result of these successive bestowal experiences. They are naturally merciful, but these experiences make them merciful in new and additional ways. These bestowals are the last steps in their education and training for the sublime tasks of ruling the local universes in divine righteousness and by just judgment.
Okay, notice the one thing there related to what I was just pointing out about this oath to synchronize with the experiential, because that's what it's all about. He has all of these existential attributes, but he has to acquire their experiential complements. As a result of these successful bestowal experiences, and then they are naturally merciful, but these experiences, that's the key. This is about acquiring a literal measure of experiential deity added to his existential deity that he has, by birth, innately.
Though numerous incidental...
Just a few pages down, when you get into the bestowals of Christ Michael, you get this interesting thing that relates to these two paragraphs that becomes something a little bit difficult to square with this oath that he's saying to the Buddha. And I think I know you, I'm sure you know where I'm going here with this. When they're talking about Michael, doing the seventh bestowal, in the intro paragraph to, or intro section there, four paragraphs in, four paragraphs in the first paper of part four.
Oh, okay.
Michael therefore had a double purpose in the making these seven bestowals on the various orders of his universe creatures. First, he was completing the required experience and creature understanding, which is demanded of all creator sons before they assume complete sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
At any time, a creator son may rule his universe in his own right, but he can rule as the supreme representative of the Paradise Trinity only after passing through the seven super universe creature bestowals. Second, he was aspiring to the privilege of representing the maximum authority of the Paradise Trinity, which can be exercised in the direct and personal administration of a local universe. Accordingly, did Michael, during the experience of each of these universe bestowals, successfully and acceptably voluntarily subordinate himself to the various constituted wills of the diverse associations of the Paradise Trinity. I won't go further than that because we're getting to another part. But it's really this part. Why say at any time a creator son may rule in his own right, when in fact, each time, you know, he's made an oath to the Paradise Trinity.
They say full responsibility.
Right, and we're actually going to talk about this at the end of this set of the preface, too. Part of what you're alluding to.
That's fine.
I'm
pointing that because we're right here.
Michael sees it. I mean, notice carefully the wording.
Mm-hmm.
Not to assume full sovereignty. He has an initial existential sovereignty, but you know. He's not staying on Paradise, which means he's, you know, by definition, going to be adding something. You can say it either way. He wants to add something, and he needs to add something. And what he's adding is this experiential. All of the parallels to what he is existentially are going to be added experientially. Just like we've talked about, how you're given this initial existential sparking by the Father, sticking in a thought adjuster into your mind. And then it's going to take you a long time to build up the experiential complement to match even the initial aspect of that you can engage. Remember, it takes you a whole local universe career to wrap your mind around just that initial impact of that. And you're not really going to get much in the way of additional initiating, father sparking, until you get the experiential synchronized with the existential. Or in order to fuse with a thought adjuster, you're a first circler for however long it takes until you can synchronize the experiential with the existential, so it locks on. There's a number of ways, a number of analogs to this.
Well, there's two aspects of this that kind of have me puzzled. It's not so much the idea of the value of achieving supreme sovereignty and experientially earning it and going through all of that. It's more a matter of these two statements.
Mm-hmm.
The statement on the one hand, that an oath is taken to the Paradise Trinity.
Okay.
As though the Creator Son ever would break that oath.
Oh, well, okay, let's answer that part first. He could break it. You know that is very important to recognize.
There is a will there.
There's a will. Uh-huh. I mean, he follows perfectly in synchrony, with that which originates from the Trinity, by choice, wholly by choice. None of it happens automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extremely important, because, at the moment that you would give a little measure of automatic character to a creator son, I mean, in a very definitive way, you can think of a creator son as your father. That would open up an opportunity for you to think, well, maybe I've got a little measure of that too, where it's automatic in me. That's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. See, that's why I brought that up, the rebellion. This is, it's literally tied. I'm not just speaking figuratively. I mean, he has to do exactly what we have to do. not make one shred of assumption that anything happens automatically. There's nothing automatic about you getting anywhere. You have to wholly choose it. You know, and that's why they say the half-hearted effort gets you what?
Nowhere.
Squat. Only the wholehearted.
Unavailing, I think.
Yeah.
Unavailing.
Now, this is so key. If he didn't wholeheartedly choose absolutely everything he does, nothing would happen. So it's really key. And it's, but then to recognize, like you brought, he brought up the full part. Again, the wholeheartedness can be spread out over time. You know, again, don't get thinking in a total father-like fiat fashion about him or you. He doesn't come wholeheartedly into being a part of the whole supremacy picture in the bottom part of the sevenfold right from the get-go. It's that wholeheartedness is spread out over time. In terms of it factually, truthfully, okay, it's right there. Factually, it's spread out over time. Just like, if you, really consecrate yourself to eternity right now in a supreme way, in truth, the adjuster considers the fusion already a fact. But, literally just in fact, you might be a long ways away from fusion yet. But, so there's that.
Yeah.
To just keep in mind.
So the only thing that's interesting here for me is that with that in mind, and we can wrap our minds around that, the idea of at any time a greater son could seize that authority, and it's even unfolded to us what could happen there. You know, the idea that if a creator son did do that, the scenario would be that Emmanuel and all the faithfuls of days would withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're representatives of the Paradise Trinity, and he would be allowed to, rule in his own right. So they talk about that scenario, a scenario that never in the universe will ever happen.
But what would happen is already, part of the picture, reminding you of how real that choice is.
Yeah, that's
about. You know, if that wasn't a real choice on his part, they couldn't tell you what would happen if he were to make the wrong choice. But the very fact that it's a fully possible possibility is reflected in the fact that there's a contingency already in place. It's never going to get used, but the contingency is there because the choice is real. Yeah, I mean, again, it's a great example of just how literal the universe is. It's not a conceptual contingency. It's a literal contingency. Everything in the universe is literal like this. That's what makes what the revelators do here in introducing us to the cosmos in the revelation so valuable, because now you can go at everything very directly, very literally, because it is. Some way, somehow, it's literal. Hence, you can visualize it with an analogies, models, you can understand it, you can think about it. Yep.
Thank you, Chris. I'm confused, or maybe. With the word merciful, I've heard or read that other Michaels or creator sons are not mercy dominated. They're
dominated is the word, everyone, all of them have mercy, but they have different, degrees, of the different facets of their characteristics, like mercy. All of them have a full measure of mercy, but the question is whether or not they lead with that facet. In the same way, if I'm a third circler and I have a full measure of engagement of all seven adjutants, I still may lead with a particular adjutant in a particular situation.
Mercy more than anything else, and didn't get it.
And so things like that, it's not just leading, for a particular situation with a particular facet of his character. you know, for the whole of the local universe, you know, it's directed by him leading with a certain facet. Okay. But, you know, and here, see, we have existential mercy, you know, ability. But he doesn't have experiential mercy ability innately. That's illogical. It has to be experientially acquired. You know, so it's mercy augmenting pre-existent mercy. That's like you're saying. I mean, they are naturally merciful, but not experientially. So you can imagine you're kind of doing it the other way. You're starting with, you know, all this ability to have experiential mercy, and then maybe you can start to have some sort of a real built-in existential-like thing that's going to get added to that. Like if you fuse with your thought adjuster and the two of you are now functioning as one, and you're adding an existential character to your experiential character, and it's just happening. It's the same idea, but just happening. You know, which leads, experiential or existential? All right, so the next one kind of expands on this.
Though numerous incidental benefits accrue to the various worlds, systems, and constellations, as well as to the different orders of universe intelligences affected and benefited by these bestowals, still they are primarily designed to complete the personal training and universal education of a Creator Son himself. These bestowals are not essential to the wise, just, and efficient management of a local universe, but they are absolutely necessary to a fair, merciful, and understanding administration of such a creation, teeming with its varied forms of life and its myriads of intelligent but imperfect creatures.
Okay, so kind of repeating it, stressing it. But just kind of notice the one thing in particular there that, you know, there's all kinds of things that you can say about the consequences and significances of bestowals. But, you know, just recognize that first and foremost, you've got to complete the factualization of this being. He's not created fully factualized. Part of his factualization is spread over time. So, you know, everything else, yes, you know, not neglecting any of its value, and it could be extreme, but, you know, first and foremost, you've got to complete these beings. They're not made initially as master sons.
Chris, it seems like more than complete, these experiences take them from being complete to what? Replete.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you can start to, you know, use some words to to reflect this. But, you know, we all know that when Michael finishes his seven bestowal, the grand universe isn't settled in light and life, so there's still something that happens after that, too. You know, we'll get to that at the end of this paper. You know, after he does this and augments himself in this way, what's the next thing that he's adding? You remember, experiential creatures are always adding something. You're always acquiring something. So you always want to say, what? During this phase, what am I acquiring? During the next phase, what will I be acquiring? Et cetera. You're always acquiring something if you're experiential.
The Michael sons begin their work of universe organization with a full and just sympathy for the various orders of beings whom they have created. They have vast stores of mercy for all these differing creatures, even pity for those who err and flounder in the selfish mire of their own production.
Take that as literally as you want.
What a strange.
Crudely and literally as you want.
But such endowments of justice and righteousness will not suffice in the estimate of the ancients of days. These triune rulers of the super universes will never certify a Creator Son as universe sovereign until he has really acquired the viewpoint of his own creatures by actual experience in the environment of their existence and as these very creatures themselves. In this way, such sons become intelligent and understanding rulers. They come to know the various groups over which they rule and exercise universe authority. By living experience, they possess themselves of practical mercy, fair judgment, and the patience born of experiential creature existence.
Okay, I mean, you probably know why they italicize no. It's not no about, it's literally no.
He owns the knowing.
He embodies the knowing, you know. He still is Jesus. That is literally, you know, that soul of Jesus fused with Michael. He still is Jesus, without delusion. It's really fun the way that these triune rulers of the super universes will never. You love how he puts that never in there. Until he has really acquired. Yeah. So, and again, like I mentioned, why are the Ancients of Days so critical here as the assessors of this situation? Because what we're assessing is whether or not, to the fullness of supremacy, you've added on this experiential nature. They are supreme Trinity personalities. They can see the full supremacy of experiential character that is rooted in, originates from the Trinity. And they have the eyes to see that. So they're the final judges of this, the completeness of this supremacy nature.
So while the ancients have that scope out ahead of these guys, are actually achieving it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, it forces you to to have a different appreciation for the ancients of days.
Maybe I should just mention that just to strengthen what we've said before about the relationship of the master spirits and the ancients of days to the levels of the mothers. Remember how we noticed when we looked on that chart how there's this sort of cross expression, this reciprocating expression. The master spirits, are behind the reflective mother spirits. They're at the individual super universe level. The ancients of days are behind, the ones that are at the collective super universe level, the unrevealed agencies, those mothers that are related to the whole of the super universe, not separately to the parts. The ancients of days are uniform all the way around. The master spirits are separate. So when you're talking about someone who really sees the whole thing, that's an ancient of days. That's not a master spirit. The closest that it comes in the master spirits is the seventh master spirit has a pretty good view of supremacy.
Touches the boundary.
And that's why he plays such a critical role in the Seventh Circuit of Avona, where you're acquiring, that recognition of supremacy and all that stuff, if you remember, from the Avona ascension. But the ancients of days, see out here, regardless of the super universe, have this viewpoint. So they serve in this role, assessing supremacy. Yep.
Oh, this is just so beautiful. It's an amazing miracle that the Creator sons go out and live the lives of the beings that they've created. And that is the path that the Father and the Trinity make for these Creator sons. And it's really easy to understand it in a very material level. If you were the CEO of a company and you had divisions all over the world, and one of the worst divisions you had was one of the divisions you had was failing, and it was a factory in Vietnam, and you actually went there and you worked in the factory and you met with the people. Your ability to understand, you might be the CEO of a $40 billion company, but there would be nothing like the understanding of spending a week at that factory in Vietnam and meeting with the families and understanding what these people are going through to be able to be this. A merciful, understanding CEO
perfectly synchronized with what's going on.
And then I just want to read one thing that just brings to me, this brings it home in such a real way. We picture Michael of Nebadon, creator's son, born on paradise. And this is where he lived. The home of Joseph and Mary was a one-room stone structure with a flat roof and an adjoining building for housing the animals. The furniture consisted of a low stone table, earthenware and stone dishes and pots, a loom, a lampstand, several small stools and mats for sleeping on the stone floor. In the backyard near the animal annex was the shelter which covered the oven and the mill for grinding grain. It required two persons to operate this type of mill, one to grind and another to feed the grain. As a small boy, Jesus often fed grain to this mill while his mother turned the grinder. What could be more perfect for a Michael son looking down on the 10 million worlds that he created with these billions and trillions of beings eventually than to have been there grinding grain with his mother? And knowing what it's like for human creatures with the foibles that we have, it's just so perfect, isn't it?
So you think his digs on Salvington are fancier than that?
Oh, Chris, that's what really makes this amazing. You got to picture where Obama lived, and you picture the houses and the institutions of the great leaders of this world. And then you picture what it might be like with the material elements, the stones, the crystals.
You could try to picture
it. The metals on the mansion world. And that's just for 1,000 planets. And then go up to the constellation and then jump up to the local universe and picture what those buildings, what the atmosphere is like for a being that is running 10 million worlds. And he is living in a one-room stone structure 2,000 years ago. And I've been going back and I've been looking at these pictures of what artists believed Nazareth looked like back then. And this is, they've had artists that went back there in the 1800s. There's a fair amount of art from these artists that actually went there in the mid-1800s and painted what it looked like back then. Well, just dial it back 1,800 years further and picture a creator son living in that condition and how he knows his creation because of that life experience.
Yeah, and just king of how he knows. That's the other word, and you stressed it. You knew you should stress it.
Yeah.
The one word in here, you know, that we I want to touch on in this paragraph. Really. Really acquired. Now think about the consequence. You know that when, you know, there's potential, actual, real. We've talked about that a lot. But think about the consequences of saying really in this. So in other words, it's something that the personality is going, his personality is going to fully engage. Well, he's a creator personality, not a creature personality. Okay, so you're not just adding divinity here. That's not gonna do it. You have to add deity. Okay, he's literally adding deity, not just more divine character. You know, he's literally adding deity because that's what his personality can realityize, can grip. He's a creator personality. It's very literal what he's doing. He's literally adding a measure of the deity of the supreme, that type of deity, the supreme type deity. Not all of that type of deity gets embodied into the supreme being. Some of that type of deity is literally being added on to this creator son. And that's why he gets a new name after he's fully added that on. He's now a master son. He's not the same deity as he was before. He's not just the father type deity and the son type deity stuck together. He's added a third type. The supreme type deity has been tacked on now. Yeah. Okay? So, let yourself recognize, see the full implications of just one word like that, tells you a lot.
Hey, Chris.
Yep.
One more point. Mm-hmm. You know how repelling it is if you work in a company or you're in an institution, and the people that lead the institution live, quote, in their ivory tower? Mm-hmm. And how you feel about that? It means that they're not real, they don't understand. And this is, isn't this exactly the opposite of living in your ivory tower?
Yeah, it's the model that everyone should seek for in a leadership role or administrative role. Yes. Are you a master CEO?
And kind of hold on to that basic thought there. Don't let me forget to allude to it. After we read this next paragraph, I want to touch upon something relative to that because it's relevant. It's interesting to think about. Okay, so a little break here. See, then it gives you this final little paragraph.
The local universe of Nebadon is now ruled by a creator son who has completed his service of bestowal. He reigns in just and merciful supremacy over all the vast realms of his evolving and perfecting universe. Michael of Nebadon is the 611-121st bestowal of the Eternal Son upon the universes of time and space, and he began the organization of your local universe about 400 billion years ago. Michael made ready for his first bestowal adventure about the time Urantia was taking on its present form, 1 billion years ago. His bestowals have occurred about 150 million years apart, the last taking place on Urantia 1900 years ago. I will now proceed to unfold the nature and character of these bestowals as fully as my commission permits.
Oh, by the way, did I mention that I'll do it as fully as my... we know how they do this. They do this all the time, you know. This is a great game they play all through the book. It doesn't have anything directly to do with that. Did I say it doesn't have anything directly to do with that?
Yeah. By the way,
it doesn't have anything directly to do with that.
I can't tell you.
Okay.
They said hi.
I can't say. So you see, he finally said it. You know, if you hadn't picked up on it, he said it point blank. Merciful supremacy. See, he's acquiring the nature of the supreme. Okay, so think for a second about this. About the scenario here. You know, if you go back and, you know, read the beginning of part three about the origin of Urantia, you know the story starts long before there was any Urantia. It starts about a trillion years ago. You know, so 400 billion years ago, you had the Andromeda Nebula and all of the other physical systems had evolved to a point where they were choosable. You know, associated physical systems were choosable as a potential local universe. So about 400 billion years ago, Michael chose that set of astronomic systems to be, you know, his local, you know, his future local universe. You know, not just Andromeda Nebula. You know, the story is Andromeda because that's where our sun came from out of all those astronomic systems, and so that's why they tell that story in detail. But so 400 billion years ago, he selects this collection of astronomic systems. And almost immediately, the power beings, you know, the directors, centers, and controllers, begin this coordinated process, you know, literally the... You know, especially the master physical controllers or the real hands-on guys, of constructing all the architectural spheres for the local universe headquarters, Salvington, and all the associated spheres, and then all of the 100 constellation headquarters spheres as well. All 101 of those full architectural systems were initiated almost right away in that very early stage of just having picked it. It hasn't really gotten very settled yet, but it's pickable. It's settled enough that it's pickable. You know, everything is kind of in the same place. You know, it isn't spread out all over the super universe and stuff. I mean, Andromeda Nebula started clear outside the Milky Way, you know, and got pulled into the Milky Way. And, you know, so it's a complicated process. But it took about 1 million years to get those 101 sets of architectural spheres built. And so once they were built, Michael and the creative spirit, you know, and 1,000 Tertiafim that accompany him as his initial staff go out. You know, and initially Michael has to stay on Salvington. He's stuck there along with the 1,000 Tertiafim helping him, and he's directing things. You know, the creative mother spirit is, or the creative spirit, excuse me, just the creative spirit is very essential to getting that final physical coordination of everything in place. Her presence there is the catalyzing physical presence that gets that gets it you know, basically to the beginning of stabilization. And once it's in that mode, then you have the primary eruption. You know, they choose they're going to start up life. Michael chooses, what happens with Creative Mother Spirit. Well, there's the primary eruption. Now she becomes the Creative Mother Spirit. And now you have all of the rest of the staff takes up residence, not just those 1,000 Tertiafim, all the rest of the staff that they need initially takes up residence on Salvington and whatnot. And that was 300 billion years ago, roughly. Okay, so you've got 100 billion years, you know, how unimaginative current science is. You know, they think the whole universe is just 13.7 billion. Okay, just this one little thing. Okay, we're talking, you know, one little phase, okay, was 100 billion years. All right. So for 100 billion years, it's just 1,002 of them there. Okay? For 100 billion years. Okay? And they can't leave. And they're stuck on the planet. They're coordinating the physical organization. Takes a long time.
That doesn't count the power beams, does it?
Well, the power beings are already out, you know. I mean, they're out and about.
And this time they have to choose to be patient.
The 1,002 are not utterly alone. It's not like they're out in the middle of the fourth outer space level, you know. There's power beings, you know.
You think you need existential level of patience?
But, you know, friend lengths are not very talkative. So anyway,
not much personality
there. But so there's 100 billion years there. Okay, and that, you know, now they're starting everything up. You know, Gabriel was the first, you know, created, and all that process, and you know, you start moving towards actually being able to have inhabited worlds and everything. And the first inhabited world was about 200 billion years ago. Okay, so there's another 100 billion years roughly of getting to the point of having the first inhabited worlds. Okay, so you have a sort of a physical coordination, then this personnel coordination, each of them taking 100 billion years. Okay, but the key is that, right, getting to that point. So the first inhabited world was about 200 billion years ago. And he didn't become a master son until just 2,000 years ago. He didn't even begin the process until a billion years ago.
Right.
Okay, so for 199 billion years, you have inhabited worlds being started up, going through the whole process, getting way deep into light and life, and you don't have a master son. Okay, all of those worlds. Think about how many worlds that would be. Those billions upon billions of years. Do you have a spirit of truth? Nope.
No.
Nowhere.
No.
Countless worlds. There's no spirit of truth. There's no supreme sovereignty. Okay. Think about how this works. See, it should really get you thinking about you know, we tend to think of ourselves like, well, you know, boy, you know, we're really something because we've got all this stuff post-Pentecost. Well, there's obviously a lot of value without that, too. And a lot of essentialness to the completion of the grand universe settling light and life and having a lot of worlds going all the way to the end point without these additional catalysts to the process.
Sir?
Yeah, yeah.
You said trillion and then 400 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists are estimating, the Big Bang scientists, 13.5
Seven.
Billion, 13.7. Where's the gap here between what they're thinking and what the book is teaching?
Everything. There isn't anything. They don't have anything right. So, I mean, everything's a gap. But, you know, I mean, most fundamentally, you know, they have a very simplistic assumption that... you know, based upon all of their various theory assumptions, they look at the expansion of the universe and they extrapolate it backward and think, well, based upon, you know, assuming that general relativity is perfect, what I've observed for the expansion of the universe is perfect, I combine the two and I run the clock backward in time and I get 13.7 billion years. Well, just think of all the ridiculous assumptions you're making there, besides the fact that you're assuming that your theories and observations are perfect. You're assuming that it's logical that that there was nothing and then magically out of nothing blurped a something. And, you know, all of these magical assumptions about this thing. You know, I could just go on and on for hours.
Come up with quantum mechanics.
It's not logical. You know, but, you know, so, but in terms of, you know, not being quite so sarcastic about it, I mean, you know, you do have this respiration, you know, that is a part of the real picture, you know, and we see we're in an outward movement right now. We see that. That's all we know. We don't know that there's a 2 billion year cycle. You know, we don't impose a God-centered reality, a logical reality upon it. So, you know, we don't have any problem with assuming that things magically something can come out of nothing and stuff like that. So, I mean, if you don't, as long as you don't want to need the universe to be logical, but just rational, expressible with mathematics, it matches all the observations. But it's obviously illogical. I gave one over here first.
I just wanted to bring up that there was no spur of the moment for the adjustments for logical intuitions. And that's on page 9-11. It says only moral and spiritual justice can be had in the spur of the moment.
Mm.
That's a spur of the moment that's mm-hmm. going to have to wait.
Yeah, definitely you're a logical acumen. You know, you're syncing up with that basic, you know, causal character of the cosmos. It's temporal by definition. You had something too.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking on the other side of the coin with the all that time where we didn't have a spirit of truth and all that, and we've now had it in the last 2,000 years. It kind of lends credence to things you said earlier before this group about, you know, that exponential curve and the, you know, being on the very brink, quivering on the very brink,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, a lot of things could be starting to move pretty quickly and in more synchrony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously.
And yeah. You know, there's a lot of people that are, you know, well, it's not going to happen for a long time.
Yeah. It's much
long
more...
Long time.
You had a Vonal Sons being bestowed, and you had their spirits poured out upon those worlds, you know, before 2,000 years ago. But it's much more a collection of parts. See, the whole thing is now there is a very definitive... You know, he's brought himself up to that which engages the whole. You know, like she did fundamentally. Now he's up to speed with where she started,
mm-hmm.
and he's up to speed a little bit with him. You know, the two have met, you know, in a middle now. So yeah, there's a super additive. There's a geometric potential now that's in play that wasn't in play for 199 billion years.
Yeah, and
in a little measure, you know, 200 billion years in full measure.
You think of that curve, and there's a point, there's a threshold where it starts to really bend upwards, you know. And,
yep. That's what's in play.
We might be getting that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I See, I wanted you, you know, just, again, so you read this, don't just read this paragraph. Think about, okay, all the other places where they talk about that. Go back, put that all together, get that full picture in your head. See, and you start to really see much more of the truth of what's going on. You start to, you know, have thoughts like you're having, see. Differentiate between what that first world 200 billion years ago is like relative to you. Okay, yep.
Two quick questions. What's a trillion years old, number one, and number two? Did you just say that a creator's son does not bestow the spirit of truth on the worlds until they become a master son?
Right. I mean, the way, remember, the way it works is all the worlds prior to Pentecost, prior to 2,000 years ago, once he becomes a master son, those spirits become augmented, boosted up to the same level as what we got, you know, right away. You know, so every abonal son throughout the whole local universe that bestowed his spirit upon those worlds when he was a bestowal son, you know, it was fully adequate. But now, you know, it's like I said, I mean, when he augments his spirit of truth to that prior spirit bestowal, it's much more like they're part of a whole now. You know, he's the common, you know, poured out upon all flesh, not just here, but all flesh. See, there's a wholeness now to the local universe that there wasn't before. Now think about the relationship that should trigger something in your mind. We talked about when we went through the whole supreme. You had the Almighty Supreme that's related to the parts, and the Universal Mother that's more related to the whole. So see how the balance is tipped. You began, before that, all those worlds were playing much more just into the Almighty Supreme, you know, or just the Almighty, say the, you know, the Almighty. That collection of parts, the summation. See, now there's a focalization, you know, that wasn't there before.
Chris,
yeah, Katie, wait, Katie has them here.
So, it's like when we, you know, it's like they fused together. You know, the mother has fused with him at that point, so that they are, you know, one in a sense. And so, you know, he has access then to the whole, you know, the whole part, all the parts.
Yeah.
And so that's how, since he now has access to that flow, he can, you know, pour out of.
Yeah, and think again, how literally that access to the whole is. Now, I've tried to point this out. Remember, a Michael, you know, Creator Son, is not ubiquitous throughout the local universe. He's at a given point, at a given time. Okay? So if he's going to pour out his spirit ministry upon all flesh, he can't do that by himself. He's not ubiquitous. She is.
Wow.
She has the spirit substrate, and once he's a master son, he has access to her spirit substrate. Before that, nope, she does not give him access. Okay, you're not going to have access to my ubiquity until you come up, till you get up to where I am. I'm ahead of you on this thing.
You've been waiting a long time.
I'm ahead of you on this, Michael. I've got this, you know. Okay? Okay?
Chris, how do you square that with the statement that the abonal bestowal of the spirit of truth is a joint bestowal of the Creator Son and the Master?
Well, I mean, that's, I mean, that, in other words, you know, they're not, you know, again, abonals are not creator beings. I mean, the Michael is involved, but it's, see, again, it's, you know, it's more of an initiator role. It's more of him as a father than him as a son, relating to them who are really functioning as the son. See, so he's behind them, you know.
Okay.
You know, initiator of them being able to do that.
But wouldn't you think that the spirit was helping him at that point? I mean, how is he getting it out there? Because he's not going out there. The abonal son is out there as sort of the, you might say, the front man.
Right. Right.
The front being. Do you think it's just the two of them, or
it's the creative mother spirit remember, has this relationship to segmented capacity. And so, I mean, she gives that a vulnerable son, you know, with Michael, you know, working behind him, access to that world, ubiquity there,
okay,
but not the whole.
Okay.
See? Yeah. So yeah. So it's a circumscribed access. You know, the fullness of Michael to the fullness of the whole is not until he's a master son.
Chris, what about these handouts?
At this rate, I think we got to do it next time. Yep. Jason.
Chris, you with the day of Pentecost, that was for a whole local universe.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm confused again.
Yeah,
I don't understand. I mean, what about
No, you're not
all in rebellion,
right? You're not confused if you think. Remember how many times in the Jesus papers they point out how he didn't just do this for this world; he did it for the whole local universe. Okay, this is a very literal example of that. That all the worlds that had already had a bestowal son, you know, and aren't in rebellion, all the worlds that already had a bestowal son, you know. Get a very literal access to what happens at Pentecost.
So they were waiting for the day of Pentecost, but what about for all other worlds after?
All the ones after us, those vulnerable sons, see, the moment that they finish up their bestowal and that spirit of truth is bestowed, it's the full supremacy-like spirit of truth, not this circumscribed spirit of truth, this more part-like than whole-like spirit of truth. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, we had all the buildup of. I thought sure we'd do this in the first section tonight. I should have known.
We should get a timer every half hour. It's time to move on.
So, you know, let's. Yeah. You know, we'll just wrap it up here, and we'll. The handout, then, we'll start with next time. What the handout does is it serves as a preface before we go into the individual bestowal, so we know the big picture before we start looking at all the parts. Okay? And so we'll hand that out next time. Let's see. Oh, wait, there was something that someone forgot to remind. What was I... going to bring up about this?
About what?
Mo made a statement, and I was going to comment how that fit in.
Andre.
I thought it had to do with this
quote. Andre made a comment, and it was something about the end paragraph.
No. Was it? No, it was about this. Andre's was about what if we got further. What
it was either after the ivory tower comment or
yeah, let's see.
After the Michael sons doing what a good CEO would do going out. And
no, it was the second comment. Let's see. Trying to think exactly what you said.
Whether they would break their oath or not.
No. Shoot. Now, see, you're supposed to help me remember so I can remember. I was going to comment on that.
He also asked what a trillion was.
Yeah, I asked you what
you asked a lot of questions.
yeah, that story starts up almost a trillion years ago because they first initiated the little whirl that became the Andronovar Nebula about a trillion years ago, you know, way outside of the Milky Way galaxy proper. You know, out in the outer regions of the super universe, and they initiated that, and then, you know, and then that got incorporated. So over all those hundreds of billions of years, finally you get to 400 billion years ago, it and all the other things, which we don't know what their origin was or history or anything, but all the stuff that ends up making Nebadon, you know, is all kind of in roughly the same place at the same time 400 billion years ago, and so he can say, okay, let's take this little region right here and make a local universe out of this.
How old is the seven super universes?
Unknown. Countless trillions. I mean, you know, I always say it that way because just think about what, you know, the way I just answered that question. If just this one minuscule little part of one super universe, it's not even, you know, it's just a part of a local universe, started a trillion years ago, I mean, how much longer ago?
How much longer?
Oh, so long ago.
Grandfather.
All right. Yeah, it's just, I mean, who knows how many trillions of years? Okay, everyone, don't get too chaotic yet here.
Paul's causing a disturbance. Come on.
Okay, yeah.
Come down out of cosmos, yep. Into our earthly existence. You know, reading about how old Michael was, I couldn't suppress a chuckle about all these guys from the Sanhedrin who tried to trip him up. And they weren't very successful.
Yeah, I wonder why. He'd been around the block a couple times. Yeah. Yeah. Because you know he's in full Michael consciousness mode at that point. I mean, think what he's got access to. I mean, just purely experientially, what he's got access to.
Yeah. Way ahead of
Let alone the, you know, who knows when, you know, he was actually created on paradise.
He didn't break a sweat, let's put it that way.
You know?
Even the lawyer.
I mean, he could have been created on paradise so incredibly long ago. You know, so. So anyway, you know, isn't that kind of interesting, you know, to just, you know, to think about how much of the local universe, you know, really happened in a very different mode than we currently think. You know, you want to kind of keep that in mind. You know, that's obviously kind of a big point. That would be probably worthy of remembering as you read a lot of things in the book and thinking about, you know, what it takes to make the supreme and the differences. You know, when they talk about the differences from one local universe to another. You know, how very different they can be. Well, just think about how very different it is then to now in this local universe. Right. There's some really big differences in play.
You were saying that in Havona, there are patterned worlds for...
Right.
How many patterns would he be drawing from to create his local universe? No, you can say. I guess number six. Okay, number question.
How many local systems are in a local universe?
Okay. All right, where are those worlds? Local worlds.
Right. But yeah, it's just that's a good point. You know, the number is not the most important thing. You know, just that the recognition of the non-singular character of a local universe. I mean, it may be one turning in a sense. You know, it's called the universe for a reason. But still, it's got some partness to it, without a doubt. It has to, because or it wouldn't have any relationship to the Almighty. And you know, it's got to be very very important part of the Almighty as well. So it has to. You know, have a lot of partness to it. And so when you think about a creator's son creating the first Adam and the first Eve, you know, first material son, I shouldn't say Adam and Eve, the first material son and material daughter for each local system, what's he doing? That creator's son is synchronizing with a given pattern world in Avona and creating a material son and daughter for this local system. And he's synchronizing with a different pattern world in Avona. And creating a material and son and daughter for this local system. It's a good thing there's reflectivity in lots of different ways, you know, that link these seamlessly together. Yeah. See how much you want. You can start making your picture richer and richer like this. You know, think about all these things together. You know, rather than just what will fit into one paragraph in a book. A paragraph is a small object. You know, not many things will fit into it. You know, so it's up to you to bring the rest of the book into each paragraph so that you can really see the truth of the paragraph. The fact of the paragraph is going to be very circumscribed. And without the rest of the book, there will be no truth flowing through that paragraph, and you're going to have nothing but more distortion of meaning when you're done reading the paragraph. It's just a given. All you could possibly do with that paragraph is put new wine in old wineskins. That's the only possible consequence of not challenging yourself of bringing the whole revelation into every paragraph, every sentence. You know?
But so, you got to go at your own pace.
Sure.
Because sometimes
sure. But that's your goal. That's your goal.
Yeah,
I mean,
right,
I mean,
right.
I'm not literally
I
thinking
agree.
Of every word in the
right.
book, but I'm trying to.
Right.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of everything in the book with every sentence I read.
How it bears.
Sometimes I'm successful in getting at least a few things at the same place at the same time, and I go, whoa, I hadn't noticed that before. You know, that's because I was bringing in some more stuff.
And it's not so much what we accomplish, it's what we try to accomplish.
You're beginning a journey. You're beginning a journey so that by the time you get to Havona, think about how many things are simultaneous in your consciousness while you're thinking about any specific thing. You know, and why, when you think about that specific thing, you can't do it in a simple little linear language. You have to have this language that that embodies a holistic character that's so transcendent of anything you can imagine right now, because that's the only way to express how you engage with what a certain particular point in front of you. You have a vast amount of the whole that's engaged to that part. And only a very non-linear, holistic language could express that. Humans basically are, you know, very animal-like in their consciousness. They go from moment to moment. So all they need is a language that goes from moment to moment. This word, and then you forget that word, and you go to the next word, then you forget that word, and you go to the next word. That's where you start out as your animal mind, you know. Think about a kid, you know. A kid has an initial challenge of actually looking at the whole word at one time. The first thing they do is they see the first letter, and then they just say whatever word starts with that letter. Okay, and then finally they can get their mind wrapped around a whole word. And then finally they can get their mind wrapped around a whole sentence. You know? And how many adults are still there? Can't yet wrap their mind around a whole paragraph, let alone a whole section or a whole paper or a whole revelation. Yeah. So that's what the revelators are challenging us to do, to have this greater and greater holistic consciousness, objective consciousness, mother-like, whole-like consciousness.
It's a present that has more past and future.
Instead of just a father who whacked, you know, the end of a line and initiated it, and you're just, you know, this little wave rolling down the line. Okay? More and more you need to eternalize your consciousness, you know, so that you span more than the moment. Yeah. I mean, that's nothing new. I mean, you know, that's all over the book, you know, that's obvious. It's just, you know, but it's sometimes it's, you know, it takes you a while for it to finally sink in, you know, and recognize that that's the fundamental challenge.
In light of you thinking about the spirit of truth having a different character, I've just been musing with an analogy, and it's like in the last 6.5 years, the last second has been of this new order. That's how fresh this is since the beginning of inhabited worlds in the local universe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a good time,
Scott. So, you know, and you know supremacy transcends, you know, most creatures' consciousness, quite extensively transcends. And that's why no one, you know, except the higher beings, have any clue about what the consequences of this are. Because more and more it's going to be holistic. You can't just have a circumscribed perspective and be able to connect the dots in it and know what's going to happen next. Something's going to come out of left field. You know, we know we're the wild card world. This is what we have to look for in spades. Well, that was a double card analogy. You know, we could get something that comes totally out of left field from a normal world perspective. You know, we could get a you know, there's all these unrevealed suns, for instance.
Yeah.
What if one of them showed up here? Something that's not even revealed in here. Well, that'd really
shake up the
mix. I mean,
well, they said stirred.
Yeah. So.
Stirred.
All right.
Well, there's other element here, and that is that, you know, I still don't know what to make of this, but this idea that there's 150,000 master sons that, you know, not long since met in conclave on paradise.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what to make of that, because if it was not long since, it could have easily included Michael,
mm-hmm.
you know, right after his bestowal. He was then a master son. But if it was 150,000, was it and a select group of creator sons, master sons, did they mean just a select group of master sons, or did they mean all the master sons? And if it was all the master sons, then since our son is number 611,121, that would make him very, very precocious. Yeah, wanting to do the bestowal experience much, much sooner than most other creator sons.
Yeah, you see, those sorts of thoughts, he's just, you know, you can start running with those. There's all kinds of speculations. Yeah.
Master sons from a local neighborhood.
Right, yeah. I see there's a lot of assumptions.
700,000 possible,
so
150,000 is a pretty big
number.
That's a big number.
Showed up for an occasion.
They sent me the memo line. But it's stuck in a relay.
All right. Let's wrap her up there.
Don has a television program.
You get the idea. You want to do what we did to this preface, you know, when you read everything. This is what it's like to bring the revelation alive. You know, and not just blow through this preface in 2 minutes, you know, when you just read, okay, next thing. I mean, challenge yourself to make it come alive. And you can see, I mean, once it starts to come alive, I mean, we could go on talking for hours, couldn't we? There's just so many things that you now see are rooted here, you know.
Suddenly it's an intensive.
Yeah. That's the point. That's the experience you're looking for. Something that just, there's not a finite number of words that can express it. Something that goes from here to eternity. All right, let's wrap it up here. Take a little moment.